We're doing in Yaakov, and we were up to the Gemara about Kafale Marke Gigit. The Gemara in the middle of the ninth chapter of Shabbos tells us the famous Medrash. The Gemara says that when the Jewish people came to Har Sinai, to Mount Sinai, Hashem lifted the mountain over them and said, if you accept the Torah, good, and if not, you'll be buried over there. And we discussed last week the Medrash Tanchuma and Parshas Noach, that says that the difference is between the written Torah and the oral Torah. The written Torah everyone wanted. The oral Torah they did not want. We discussed the application based on the different commentaries, including the Maharal. We ended last week with the Maharal that explains that the people all want a direct connection to Hashem. And that's why when it comes to Torah, people are more resistant to accepting tradition, because every person wants to feel connected to the Torah. I don't want to feel like I need someone else to tell me what Hashem said. And that's why the Maharal explains people would naturally prefer Torah shebichtav. And then we also discussed the Medrash Tanchuma that explains that the people prefer Torah shebichtav because you understand what you're reading. And when you approach Torah shebal peh, the Medrash Tanchuma says, it's much more difficult. It's like going at night till you figure out what the Talmud's saying. And then the Talmud says, actually, I changed my mind. Or not, I changed my mind, but I have a proof against it. So then you figure out what the proof against it. And then the Talmud says, but I have a proof for it. And then you go back and forth until you figure out what the bottom line is. They tell you, oh, the bottom line is in another tractate. Here we leave it hanging. In another tractate, you'll learn the bottom line. It's very hard. Torah shebal peh, learning Talmud is hard. So we saw these two approaches to why, when it came to Torah shebal peh, the oral law, the Jewish people needed to be forced into it. Now the Gemara says, Mikan moda rabba leoraita. But before we read that line, I have a question. What percentage of what we do on an average day is the written Torah, and what things are Torah shebal peh? Let's think for a minute. How many mitzvot d'oraita did we do today? How many biblical mitzvot did we do today? Shema. We read Shema this morning. Okay, that's one mitzvah d'oraita. What else? Berkat Hamazon. Very good. That's another mitzvah d'oraita. We put on tefillin. Okay, what else? What? Birkot HaShachar is not. Birkot HaTorah, we learned last night, a machloket, that it might be d'oraita. Very good. So far we've gotten four, right? Tefillin, Kriyat Shema, Birkat HaMazon, and possibly Birkot HaTorah. Let's take those four. You read the Torah, V'achalta V'savata. Oh! Every word of Torah. Every word of Torah is another mitzvah d'oraita, right? Now let's look at any one of those mitzvot. How are we supposed to do it? The Torah says, V'achalta V'savata U'V'rachta. You will eat, you will be satiated, you will bless. What am I supposed to do? Thank you, Hashem, the food was great. How do I know? Chazal say, no. There are three blessings. You have to talk about the land of Israel. You have to talk about the covenant. You have to talk about the circumcision. You have to thank Hashem for Jerusalem. And that's all biblical. That's all d'oraita. So if you take the written Torah without the oral Torah, what do you have? Vayul totafot ben inecha. Wear a jewel between your eyes. Right? So we'll all look like the Hindu. We'll have a red mark in between our eyes. That's what it says. Ukshotam lot al yadecha, tie them as a sign on your hand. So maybe we'd all wear a bracelet, tie it to our hand. How do you know that al yadecha means all the way up here on the arm, opposite the heart? Tie them. Does it say how? Which straps? Maybe I should make a string. Does it say it should be black or green or yellow? Does it say how I should make the tefillin? How I should tie the tefillin? Any mitzvah we look at, if you try to keep Torah without the oral Torah, if you don't have the Torah shebal peh, you really don't have anything. I mean, you can't get it right. I'm saying there's no way to have the written Torah without the oral tradition. And we know that throughout our history, there were people who tried challenging it. It started with Korach, who said Moshe Rabbeinu's telling us the accurate story. And then we have, throughout the days of the second Beit HaMikdash, we have the Tzdukim Baitusim, the Sadducees, and the, I don't know how you translate Baitusis. You had the Karaites later on. You had the Kutim, from the time of the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, that the Syrian king brought in the Kutim, who did not accept the oral tradition.
When were the Karaites?
The Karaites, Rambam says, was an involvement of the Tzdukim and Baitusim. That's what Rambam writes. So there was always this challenge not to accept the oral tradition, and whoever didn't accept it ended up keeping a very different Torah than we keep. Torah says on Shabbos, Al Yetzei Ish Mimekomo. No person should leave their place or stay seated all of Shabbos. That's not such a fun Shabbos. Torah says, you're not allowed to lo tevaru eish b'chol moshevoteichem b'yom HaShabbat. Don't burn a fire wherever you are on the day of Shabbos. No fires burning. Put out all the fires. No hot food. That's why the Rosh says, and that's how we rule in Shulchan Aruch, that every Jew has to eat or drink something hot on Shabbos. Every Shabbos, you could have a cup of tea, but you have to take something hot to show that we accept the oral tradition. That even though the Torah says, don't have any fire burning, I have something hot on Shabbos. I have a fire burning. I know the tradition that it means don't burn a fire. I'm allowed to leave a fire burning. Right? Lo tevaru, don't actively burn a fire. So the whole Torah really is contingent on the oral Torah. What happens if someone wakes up one morning and says, I don't want to keep the oral Torah, only the written Torah. So from our end, he's not keeping any Torah. There's no one without the other. You need both together. Says Rav Acha Bar Yaakov, Mikan moda'a rabba lo raita. If we were forced into it, so now we have a really good excuse. Anytime Hashem says, why didn't you keep the Torah? We say, hey, you forced us into it. What do you mean, why didn't we keep it? So on the one hand, we're held accountable. On the other hand, we do have some level of an excuse where when Hashem takes the Jewish people to task, the Jewish people have an answer. Did I have a choice? You forced me into this. But that was only true till the period of Mordechai and Esther. When was the period of Mordechai and Esther? Okay, so let's do a quick review of Jewish history, okay? Are we ready? We'll begin. We have creation. Creation begins with the Temple Mount. Hashem creates that, and from there evolves the rest of earth. We have 10 generations from Adam to Noah, 10 generations from Noah to Avram. 1948, Avram is born. 4 generations, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov. Yaakov has a son, Levi. Levi has a daughter, Yocheved. Yocheved's son is Moshe. So Moshe is Yaakov's great-grandson, right? Yaakov's son is Levi. Levi's daughter is Yocheved, and then Moshe. So Moshe's grandfather was Levi. His great-grandfather was Yaakov Avinu. So Moshe Rabbeinu leads us in up to the land of Israel. We leave Egypt in the year 2448, 40 years in the desert, 2488, we enter Israel. We have the period of Shoftim, judges. We have the period of kings, King Saul, David, the Davidic dynasty. The dynasty is divided in two. We have the northern kingdom, southern kingdom, destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. So far we're all together. Okay, the northern empire was exiled. Southern empire gets remnants of the northern empire. You get refugees who run into the south, and so we have some residual representation of each of the 12 tribes. And then we have another century and a half until the southern empire is exiled to Babylon. Northern empire disappears. We have no idea where the lost 10 tribes are. We're still studying them in Jewish history. Bottom line, from our perspective, most of them disappeared. We have a representation of each tribe among us. Okay, now we're out in exile. And we have the first Koresh. The Persian Medes overtake the Babylonians and they free all the Jewish slaves and they send the Jews back to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. And this is the opening line of the book of Ezra, which is the concluding line of the book of Divrei Hayamim. The last two verses of Divrei Hayamim Chronicles are the first two verses of the book of Ezra. It's a continuation where Koresh says, whoever wants to go and rebuild the temple, we invite you to go, we will fund you, go, and we will give you, and everyone should support them, we will give you the wherewithal, be it the materials you need to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, be it the sacrifices, the money, everything you need, go. And so Ezra ascends to Israel. Great. They show up to Israel. They start rebuilding the temple. What happens next? The people in Israel write a letter to Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus in the story of Esther. And they tell him, did you study history? Do you know the history of this city? This is a city that was always used to rebel against the world. And you appointed Zerubbabel, their prince, in charge of all of us. The Edomites, the Moabites, the four kingdoms that are neighbors to Israel were all told, you will listen to Zerubbabel, the Jewish prince. So they said, your majesty, we only want your interest. We're only talking here for your interest. You know what a destruction will come to the world? If you let the Jews rebuild the second Beit HaMikdash, that will be the source of all rebellion against your kingdom. Study the history of this city. They are trying to fortify it all over again to start a new rebellion against you. We highly recommend you don't do this mistake. It will be the destruction of your kingdom and world peace. It will be the destruction of the Middle East. If the Jews become powerful, it will be terrible for everyone. And Ahasuerus accepts their claim. And he sends word back to the Jews in Israel and says, you may not continue rebuilding the second Beit HaMikdash. And this is where the story of Purim begins. Where the Jews in Israel, who have been sent there by the king and funded by the king, are suddenly finding themselves with the king who turned against them. Ahasuerus says, no rebuilding the second Beit HaMikdash. I know what you guys are up to. This is not going to happen. And he sends word to the four neighboring kings and he says, don't let there be any mistake in interpreting what I've just said. You ensure that the Jews don't rebuild that second Beit HaMikdash. And so now the work has come to a pause. And the Jews are in a problem. Because their enemies have the king's ear. There's this top scribe whose name is Shimshi, the son of Haman, who has the king's ear, and he keeps telling the king bad things about the Jews in Israel. And the Jews in Israel are stuck. They're very poor. And they went there with the king's license. And now the new king says no. And then Haman gets the right by the king to put out a decree to annihilate all the Jews. And so the wave that has been coming against the Jews were sure there's a renaissance, we're coming back, we're rebuilding, and suddenly this wave becomes a tidal wave, a tsunami of anti-Semitism, where there's an official letter by the king that says, in a year's time, everyone can be prepared to kill all the Jews. Which is not hard to believe, because the non-Jews were upset at us. A, we rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. Over and over again, they trusted us, and we broke our word to them. B, we were enslaved in Babylon, and the Persian Mede Empire freed the Jews from their slavery. So now, the non-Jews looked at the Jews and said, we captured you, you were our slaves, now you're free men. We're not so happy about that. You used to be our workers. And when the Persian Mede Empire freed us, the people weren't too happy with the Jews. It only helped fuel the anti-Semitism. So now when Ahasuerus sends word, you can annihilate the Jews in all your towns. Here's the day. Get ready. The Jews were sure they were finished. And then they suddenly discover that there's one man who they didn't like listening to. His name is Mordechai. And Mordechai told them, you guys have to be very careful. You're very loyal citizens to the king. You think that that's what's going to save you in the world. He invites you to parties that are not kosher, and you go. Parties where his intention is to mock the temple, and you go. Now we understand why it was so grave that they were willing to mock the temple, to use the temple vessels at Ahasuerus' party. This is the Ahasuerus that rescinded the license to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. This is the Ahasuerus who will ultimately put out a decree to annihilate them. So Mordechai, who has been constantly warning them, your loyalty to the kingdom is dangerous. It can ultimately backfire. You have to be loyal to the Torah. And they all mocked him. And then Mordechai turns the tables on everyone. He is the most powerful person in the kingdom. He gets Haman killed. He saves the day. He volunteers his own wife, his niece, who was his wife, becomes the queen. And through her, we have the saving of the whole Jewish people with the story of Purim. Now the Jews look back and they say, wait, who said they don't want to listen to a rabbi? Wait a second. This was all oral law. This wasn't the written law. This was all the understanding of Mordechai, the sage of the men of the great assembly, that saved the day. We didn't like him. We didn't want to listen to him. And now we realize what he said was right. That's the concept that the Gemara now tells us. Hadur kiblua. In the days of Ahasuerus, the Jewish people again accepted the Torah. When they saw how Mordechai was right in the end, and how he saw things that they did not see, and ultimately he saved the Jewish people, then the Jewish people of their own volition said, we hereby accept the oral law. If until now we did it because Hashem held a mountain over our heads, now we accept it of our own will. And that's what the Pasuk says, Ki yimu v'kibelu ayudim. The Jewish people, when they accepted Purim, they didn't just accept the holiday of Purim. They accepted the concept that what we accepted previously with a mountain over our head, to accept the oral tradition, to accept what the rabbis teach, now we accept it willingly. No one's holding a mountain over our head. We've come to the realization this is important. Ki yimu v'kibelu. When the Jews accepted Purim, they didn't only accept Purim. They accepted the whole concept of the oral law of their own volition. Ki yimu v'kibelu kvar. And that's what ultimately leads to the rebuilding of the Second Temple and the whole era of the men of the Great Assembly. We know that almost all the Judaism we do is the men of the Great Assembly. They're the ones who taught us how to make Kiddush Friday night, how to make Kiddush Shabbos day, how to make all the blessings, how to say the Shmoneh Esrei. Until then, we knew there was a mitzvah to sanctify the day of Shabbos. But every person could use their own way of sanctifying Shabbos. There wasn't one blessing. They codified it. Until then, everyone knew they should pray every morning and every night. But everyone said what they said. Thank God you woke me this morning. Make me successful in my business. Thank you, Hashem. And then they went out to work. So their prayer was not codified. The men of the great assembly, of whom Mordechai was a member, they're the ones who codified things. And the Judaism we know today was that period. But that period was all a product of Kimu v'Kibilu. And that's what the Gemara says. Even though Hashem held a mountain over their head, but they outgrew that. In the days of Purim, they came to the realization and the voluntary acceptance of the oral tradition. What did we learn today? So we learned in the Chafetz Chaim, we learned about the prohibition of saying Lashon Hara about any person, and the more weighty prohibition of saying Lashon Hara about someone who's learning in Torah, the impact of that Lashon Hara on the public perception of Torah and those who teach it. And then here we learned that the fact that we were forced into the oral tradition was actually an excuse that we held on to. We were forced into it. But in the days of Achashverosh, the Jews lost that excuse because they willingly accepted the oral tradition and the teachings of the sages.